Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got health insurance woes, the World Congress of Families, Salt Lake City politics, and much more. And joining me this morning in Studio Tribune, health reporter Kristen Moulton joins us. Hi, Kristen.
Good morning.
Also with us, investigative reporter Matt Canham joins us. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Justice reporter Jennifer Doebner, not caffeinated. Jennifer, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And political reporter Christopher Smart. Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning, everybody.
And you can join us, too, with questions, comments about the week's news. You can send those to the hashtag TripTalk on Twitter. You can put comments on the website, sltrib.com, or you can call us live, 801-355-TALK is that number. Kristen, I'm going to start with you. The state's second largest insurer. Is that?
It's the second largest on the exchange.
On the federal exchange.
On the federal
exchange. Going out of business and it's not by choice. Tell us what the Department of Insurance did this week, their actions against Arches Health Plan.
The Department of Insurance put them in receivership, which means that it will be overseeing they're dissolving all their plants. So what it means is that there are 66,000 Utahns who get their health insurance through Arches. Some of them are brand new customers just in the last couple months because they came in with some corporate plans. But anyway, the state is saying that this is the last year you'll have Arches insurance. They'll be able to pay any claims through this year or that are incurred this year through early next year. But the main thing was the insurance department was worried that Arches did not have deep enough pockets to get through next year's claims, health insurance claims. So
can you remind our listeners how Arches Health Plan came to be?
Yeah, it came about as part of the Affordable Care Act. 23 states created these co-ops, and they were intended to be in a way, they were sort of a tip to the liberals, tip of the hat to the liberals, allowing a insurance company to come in and compete against a lot of deeper pocketed, many for-profit institutions. They were intended to be member-owned. They are member-owned. They were supposed to be lower cost, and they were just a way of infusing some competition into the market, especially in rural areas where there often is very little competition. So that is one of the biggest costs here, too. In Arches going away, in 20 counties of Utah, there will be no competition on the exchange to Select Health, which is owned by Intermountain Healthcare.
So what went wrong with Arches?
You know, all of the insurance companies had much higher claims than they expected in the first year of the Affordable Care Act. A lot more sicker people who had put off health care for many years finally had health insurance and came out of the woodwork. And so costs were higher all the way around. They had already proposed much higher rates for next year because they realized that they had set the rates too low in 2014. Arches had even higher than anyone else. Molina is one company just mostly in the Salt Lake area, and they didn't have they were not raising the rates much next year, but Arches was raising theirs on an average of 43%. So they underestimated how costly newly covered people were going to be.
Hmm. So Arches is not the first insurance health plan to fail.
They're the 10th of these co-ops. 10 of them have now failed in the last, I think Nevada might have been the first in August, but they've been folding left and right in the last couple months.
What does this say about the ACA, about the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, what do the customers do now?
You know, I mean, it may say more than this, but one thing it does say is how political it is, because one of the reasons these co-ops are failing is because Congress and Obama did sign the bill after the Affordable Care Act came in 2013. They passed legislation that made it's so that these co-ops would not get covered for their losses as much as they had expected. So when they were organized, they expected that they would have better coverage than Congress now is allowing them to have for their losses. It's called the Risk Corridor Program. They expected their losses there would be sharing among the insurers and that there would be some more better cushion for their losses. Well, Congress changed that after approving the Affordable Care Act, a different Congress. So anyway, you know, what it means is it's political. So one of the problems they're having is because of changes in Congress, and it just shows how political it is.
Okay.
Of course, Senator Hatch said it shows Affordable Care Act is totally botched and a bad idea.
So do you think as these companies fail, Congress will revisit? I mean, there have been a lot of calls to repeal Obamacare. I'm not sure how practical that is, but...
They're not going to revisit the risk corridor program. They're going to revisit Obamacare in total.
66,000 Utahns. Will other insurers step into the void? You said that there's only one insurer that's an option for people who live in rural Utah. Do you think that people will see an opportunity for competition?
Well, you know, there are other insurers in rural Utah that are
on
off
the exchange.
But on the exchange, you know, I just don't know how it could possibly happen because this is Utah uses the federal exchange and it goes live Sunday morning. I don't know how they could possibly get up all the permutations of plans they offer. Every company offers like 40 different plans because if you're single, if you're a silver plan, bronze plan, platinum plan, you know, for all the different sizes of families and whatnot, I just do not see that website could be updated and ready to go with anybody else's plans. Plus, there's a reason the companies didn't want to serve rural Utah in the first place. There's not much money to be made there.
You mentioned that the exchange opens as of Sunday. Are advocates worried that people are going to stay away from... what effect is this going to have on signups for the federal exchange?
You know, I don't think they're predicting that so much, but they are predicting overall there will be fewer new people coming onto the exchange this year anyway, because there was so much pent-up demand. The people who most needed health care went on in 2014 and 15. They weren't expecting as many to come on in 2016. But on the other hand, your tax penalties for not having insurance do go up next year. So... you know, I don't think they expect people will just move to other plans. But if it gets costlier and costlier, people aren't going to be getting health care.
Huge story. Kristen Moulton, thank you so much for the recap. Another big story today, I believe, is the final day for the World Congress of Families, which has been meeting in Salt Lake City this week. Stirred up a lot of controversy. And Jennifer Dobner, you were stepping your toe into that conference. Tell us a little bit about the group.
Yeah, so I wrote quite a bit about them before they came. They're a little bit controversial. It's a very conservative sort of coalition of educators and some political people and religious people and whose ideology swings very right and is... and promotes primarily sort of what they call the natural family or the traditional family, some people call it, a man and a woman married and raising children. They have been dubbed a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. There's been a lot of pushback against them by the National Human Rights Campaign. And so there was quite a lot of concern about them coming to Salt Lake City this year. They've been here since Tuesday. I think actually they have one event tomorrow evening before they all go home. There's about 3,000 of them here at the Grand America. And they've been having plenary sessions and panel discussions every day about various aspects of what they consider societal harms to families and children, some of which probably all of us would agree that divorce is really, you know, tough for kids and that education and how you approach education is important for raising up the next generation. But the conversations are really decidedly from one sort of very right point of view.
And if there's been a prevailing theme, at least in the reports that you and our colleague Peggy Fletcher Stack have filed, it's a directive to fight the legalization of gay marriage. Describe some of the comments that have been made.
Yeah, they obviously were upset, many of these folks, by the Supreme Court ruling that legalized gay marriage. I was at a session on Wednesday morning where they talked about strategies for overturning the ruling, you know, much in the way conservatives have fought abortion, Roe v. Wade, for 30 years now. They encouraged people to, well, first of all, engage in politics at all levels, to hold your elected leaders accountable for their positions on marriage.
And the court rulings are fallible or can be changed.
Well, I mean, they raised actually some interesting points that there are time in history when the court said that, say, an African-American couldn't have full citizenship, was two-thirds of a person, or that you should have, you know, compulsory sterilization for some segments of the population who didn't have. All those rulings have changed over time, and they believe that this is one that should be changed over time as well.
Interestingly, it seems that there's been some pretty blunt rhetoric, but at the opening session, a Mormon apostle chose a more diplomatic approach. He encouraged compassion and kindness toward those who don't fully embrace the concept of the so-called natural family. I mean, how did that call for civility go over?
Well, I think what Elder Ballard did, Russell M. Ballard, I think what he did was maybe speak the Mormon party line. The Mormons have worked really hard to forge relationships in the LGBT community. They have been, their rhetoric has been very, very much about love and compassion and about reaching out and listening. We've seen that in Salt Lake City through the passage of non-discrimination laws. But they have a long relationship with the World Congress of Families. They've been participating in this with this group for more than a decade, and so I think I think everyone was respectful, but whether or not it was the message that they exactly wanted to hear, some of the stalwarts, I'm not sure.
You noted that not everybody's on board. There's been some strong opposition to the Congress coming protests this week.
Yeah, there was one last night, kind of small, maybe partly because of the weather, but about 50 people came out. It was led by Restore Our Humanity, a local LGBT rights group. Sim Gill was there, the Salt Lake County District Attorney, and spoke with. And their message really has been that love is the thing that creates family, not gender, not sexual orientation, love. And so they, one of the concerns that these folks have with the World Congress of Families is that they believe that their rhetoric around the world has been very anti-gay, anti-transgender, and that has led to putting policies in place that allow for direct harm to individuals. And so they raised those concerns again last night.
Okay. We've had the World Congress of Families, the Parliament of World Religions, General Conference. It seems like, are we done?
Well, and we had the Inclusive Families
the
Conference,
inclusive
and then
families.
There was the LGBT Faith and Families Power Summit. For some reason, October is like Summit Conference Month in Utah. It is quite interesting that a lot of these are national groups who have converged here. And so you have to sort of ask the question, what is it about the timing of this? Or is it, is the Mormon Church the draw that people are trying to forge relationships with the church institution and the influence that it has around the world? I don't know that we have any answers to that, but it was really quite something. And there's a couple of us on staff that are really tired.
Of course. Kristen, you're not covering this directly, but you've covered religion for quite some time. Any observations about the World Congress?
Well, yeah, and I did help cover the Parliament of World Religions, and it wasn't a national draw. These are both international movements. And I wonder, too, as these conferences get planned years in advance, it could have been that the Mormon Church was in the spotlight so much Romney's campaign and during the
Proposition 8
and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They were probably planning then, let's go to Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. So it probably was years in the making brought two international groups here, 2 weeks apart.
I would say one thing about the World Congress of Families, and Peggy Fletcher Stack and I were talking about this yesterday, that it really had like this old tent revival feel to it. There was a lot of a few amens, but there was a lot of wild clapping, standing ovations, people saying yes, agreeing with point of views, and it really did have sort of a throwback feel to another time.
And is it largely evangelicals too?
A lot of evangelicals, yes.
So I think that's an interesting dynamic also with the LDS Church and the evangelicals not always standing together.
As that movement is called. But that and in fact the guy who founded the Standing Together,
Greg Johnson.
Is that right? Yeah, he spoke the morning that I was there about, you know, same-sex marriage and the concern that he sees with that. But and yet the also a lot of conservative Catholics attended this week, and so but it did, it really had that revival feel, and you could, and these are people united in a purpose and a point of view.
Revival as a spiritual motivation, revival as a political call to action.
I think both. I mean, I think those things in this particular group, for me anyway, my observation was that those things are very much intertwined. That religious point of view, conservative religious point of view, is really driving their policy and their politics. There was a call to hold the national GOP accountable for its stand on marriage and not to buckle to what they said, what some said was sort of like the pressure from the liberal elites to, and they included the media in that, to just cave on what they think is the truth of marriage.
We have full coverage of the World Congress of Families Conference on the website. You can check it out, sltrib.com. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Send a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We'll be right back. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here with Matt Canham, Chris Smart, Jennifer Dobner, and Kristen Moulton. Again, join us if we're talking about stories that you care about. 801-355-TALK is the number. You can tweet us to the hashtag TribTalk. Let's go to city politics. This is the last weekend before Election Day. Tensions between the candidates are pretty high. But we didn't see much of that tension during a debate sponsored by the Tribune this week. For the most part, Christopher Smart, the candidates were cordial, they were civil, but they did have some issues that separated them.
They did, and I think Ralph Becker was perhaps used harsher language as the campaign has gone on, not the language itself, but the meaning. He said that his opponent, Jackie Biskupski, really didn't have any plans, that everything that she put out was just sort of window dressing, and he was the guy who had the vision and had started all these programs in Salt Lake City. Throughout the campaign, and this goes back before the primary when there were four challengers. All those people criticized Becker. And in that criticism, Biskupski has kept up that criticism over the fall campaign. So the tension each week has mounted. And the tension right now is very high. It's particularly high in the Becker campaign. He was behind, had a big gap to make up after the primary. The latest Dan Jones poll showed Jackie with a slight lead, but it was within the margin of error. The Tribune has not done a poll in the last few weeks. Our poll was very accurate leading into the primary. The Dan Jones poll wasn't so accurate, and their latest poll was of only 330 likely voters. So
pretty small sample.
It's a small sample, and I don't think, at least I don't have a feel right now for how this is going to turn out.
Well, what are the issues do you think are going to draw people to mail in that ballot? What are the key distinctions between them?
Well, one issue that has really resonated in the mayor's favor is billboards. Reagan Outdoor Advertising put up a whole bunch, maybe 15 or 16 billboards for Jackie. They did that independently through a PAC. Ralph Becker's got this long history of fighting billboards. And so that has resonated among residents. Going the other way, there are a host of small issues that seem to be mounting up in Jackie Biskupski's favor. They run from parking meters to the new $120 million theater to dog parks to streetcars. And so it's he's been in office 8 years, so it's given him a chance to, you know, get various groups upset with him over that long, you know, long 8 years. So I think that it's really coming to a referendum on Ralph Becker. And so there, his proponents really think he's just absolutely great. And there are other folks out there who say, well, time for a change.
You noted in an article this week the difference in how they think about use of force and police, security, public safety issues. What are the differences there?
Well, this bubbled up in one of the debates that you were hosting. And the question came from the audience asking the candidates to make a statement regarding the shooting deaths of Darian Hunt and Dylan Taylor. Now, Darian Hunt was a young man who was shot in Saratoga Springs. He had wielded a sword, but was running from police when he was shot. Dylan Taylor was in Salt Lake City at a convenience store, 21st South and State. A call came in saying that there was a man with a gun at this place. And so the police came. Dylan Taylor was shot to death. He was not armed. So Jackie Biskupski said in her mind those two shootings were not justified. And at that debate, Ralph Becker said that if he were in the police's, if he were to be there as an officer, he probably would have done the same thing the officers did. The problem is that the confusing part of this is that he was confusing Darian Hunt with James Barker. James Barker is the guy on the avenues who had a snow shovel and was going around looking for work. Some neighbors called, the police arrived, an argument ensued. James Barker hit the officer with his snow shovel. They wrestled, the officer shot him, and he died. So Becker said he was talking about that, not Darian Hunt. But at any rate, it gets back to Biskupski's characterization of the improper training of police. She believes that more could be done to de-escalate these situations. She was not referring specifically to James Barker, because I think that once, that situation could have turned out much differently, but once he hit the officer, that changes everything. She does have the support of the Salt Lake Police Union. And so it's, you know, the police have been controversial throughout this campaign, and it goes all the way back to June when Chris Burbank was forced out as chief. That was over sexual harassment. And that one issue is perhaps the biggest issue in the negative column for Ralph Becker.
Mm. Matt, Jennifer, you were both at the debate on Wednesday night. What struck you about this debate, Matt?
You know, this is, they've had, I don't know, more than a dozen debates. And so a lot of the big issues we've heard of, kind of like with Chief Burbank, though I want to point out he didn't do the sexual harassing. It was the way he handled
right.
a brother case.
Yes. That's correct.
Just to point out for Chief Burbank.
Yeah, that's correct.
You asked a few personal questions that I thought were kind of interesting. Both candidates said they felt unsafe downtown. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting to see whoever the mayor is has felt unsafe in our downtown, and it would be interesting to see what they want to do about that. I also thought it was interesting that Jackie has said that she doesn't feel safe riding a bike in the city when that is one of Ralph's big things. So I thought there were some very interesting personal differences about it. This race, one of the weird dynamics of this race is that it's the first time we did mail-in ballots. And so we are now in the stretch run, and in a normal campaign, everything is hyped for these last few days, the get-out-the-vote mm-hmm. effort, and it's all geared towards one thing. And this is the first time we've done this, and it feels like there's a little bit of uncertainty of how to act.
Well, absolutely, we felt that at the debate.
Right.
Because I think that the vast majority of people who attended had already cast their ballots, so they had made up their minds.
And the candidates kind of felt like, okay, I'm doing this because there's a week to go and I need to do as much as I can, but I'm not really sure if this is a big deal or not a big deal. And we don't know. I mean, honestly, that's the answer. We don't know how this kind of cycle works. When do people mail in their ballots? Are they going to do it at the end? Or have they already done it since they've had the ballot in their hands for weeks? You know, and I think that's an interesting part. Right now, Salt Lake County has about a third of the ballots back, I think is what they've said. That's a pretty high turnout for mm-hmm. a mayoral race. And we don't know how high it's going to go.
All right. Jennifer Dobner.
I'm curious about this mail-in ballot and how it is going to change that equation. If we will get a much better turnout because people have aren't rushing to go, you know, on right. election day. And but I'm guessing this is going to be pretty close, like a few hundred votes maybe at the very end. I don't know what you're thinking, Chris.
I just don't have a feel for it at all. But for the primary, the August 11th primary, we had about a 40%. Vote tally for registered voters in Salt Lake City. 40% in an August election is just sky high for us. So I think the turnout will be high. I'm not sure who that favors. I think that, you know, clearly Becker has closed the gap, but I just don't know how close.
And he started this with a big war chest. How has he been spending the money? How are the candidates? I mean, the fundraising has been coming into Mascoupski as well. So how are they spending that money?
Well, Ralph has had access to over $800,000, and he's spent that. And he's done TV. He's done direct mail. A lot of it goes to paid staff, and there's been a lot of, you know, door-to-door. And Jackie also, since the primary, has raised a whole bundle of money, and she, too, has spent, you know, $600,000-plus. But I don't know if she did TV. I haven't seen any of her spots.
She has done some TV ads.
She did.
I watch a lot more sports than you do.
Okay. She hasn't okay. So I think up till now, these Salt Lake City mayor's races have not used TV very much because, you know, it goes out everywhere, and it's not just Salt Lake City voters. Traditionally, the way you win a race is as mayor is you go to a lot of community meetings, meet with every organization that'll listen to you, and you go door to door. One of the things that Ralph Becker's done is he has used Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams in ads, on television, on direct mailing. Ben McAdams is on our website in an ad paid for Ralph Becker, and that's pretty amazing. And at one time, McAdams sort of did a backhanded slap at Biskupski, saying that she really wasn't a good leader. So it's been a real intense campaign, and an expensive one.
Go ahead, Jennifer, then Matt.
One of the things that I do think is interesting is that although this is technically a nonpartisan race, right, you're pitting here a Democrat against a Democrat in Salt Lake City, which is pretty much the only place a Democrat gets elected. And so that really splits the pool, right, of support and of money. And when you start to see, like, who's lining up with whom in terms of endorsements, it might put the party in kind of an unusual and maybe a slightly uncomfortable place. Because Jackie and Ralph were on the same team when they were at the legislature, and now they're, you know, duking it out at the library on Tuesday.
It's a healthy place. I mean, this is what democracy is,
correct.
Right? And it's great to kind of see this because we don't see it all the time in this state.
Right.
A close race is kind of fun for us political reporters. And, I think one of the things I wanted to point out is you talked about Ben McAdams, a very prominent Democrat in the state, backing Ralph. In response, Jackie's ads feature state House members, state senators, and Sheriff Jim Winder, whom she works for, all Democrats, trying to counter that look that Ben is the one who's backing Becker, and so he has the establishment. They are both fighting on the same turf for establishment, for activists, for money. They have gone toe-to-toe the whole race.
So my question would be, is the LGBT community vote going to be the thing that sways this? Because she's our first openly gay candidate for this office, and will that swing it? The gay community has a lot of power
fantastic that wasn't an issue in the debate
yeah.
at all. You know, the only person who brought up that was her in her closing argument. The gay issue is interesting because not all of the prominent gay community members in Salt Lake are endorsing her.
Mm-hmm.
And Equality Utah actually endorsed both candidates.
Right.
So there is some identity politics, both that she could be
right.
One of the very few female mayors the city has ever had. I think the second one.
Right, after Dee Dee.
At the first, openly gay mayor. There's some history there, but this race has really been about how to handle the police and, mm-hmm. Economic development, transportation. It's been a real slog on the issues. And the identity politics really didn't raise as much of become a bigger issue as I actually thought it would be at the start of this. I don't know about you, Chris.
It has fractured the nice little Democratic family in Salt Lake City. People who have been friends for decades are now really angry with each other, and who knows, maybe we'll never talk again. It's behind the scenes. It's extremely bitter among the Democrats.
We need to wrap up the topics and move on to some other stories, but I saw a piece on KUTV. They're reporting that a message on a Reagan billboard that supports Jackie Biskupski has changed from "she will end homelessness" to "she will address homelessness." So Deseret News is reporting this morning that Becker is accusing Biskupski of distributing misleading flyers at the U. How are the candidates going to spend their time this weekend, Chris Smart?
I think they'll just be going door to door, and I don't know what else they can do. This hurling of allegations at the last minute, I think, shows that the Becker camp is not confident. Meanwhile, the Biskupski camp looks confident. I think Biskupski thinks she's in a good place. I think Becker is less sure.
Well, we will see. And you can find all the results early or late Tuesday, early Wednesday at sltrib.com. Okay, let's move on to another really big story. Envision Utah, this top planning group, surveyed thousands of us Utahns about what we want the state to look like in 2050. This week we got the results. They sort of break down by category.
Lots of categories.
Lots of categories. Tell us some of the goals that the conclusions.
This is the most expansive survey I've ever reported on.
It's like 50,000 respondents.
53,000 respondents on 11 topics. There's all kinds of questions. But there were some interesting insights, some of which we kind of already going. More dense housing, concerns about air quality, trying to increase the quality of education. Those are all things that, you know, the state's had as goals for a long time. There were a couple things that I thought were kind of interesting. There was a great desire to eat food produced in the state, that they want to increase that. Now, we produce enough grains and cattle for pretty much everyone in Utah. We produce enough fruits and vegetables for 4% of Utahns. Mm. And, you know, there are areas of our state that have long had a history in that, but they become residential neighborhoods for the most part. So there's an idea of trying to get back to growing our own food. That might take a lot of urban farming. So there's a lot of talk about how do you do that in sustainable ways? How do you get the food to producers? And it's this mix of an urban and rural issue that I thought was kind of interesting that came out of it. There was talk about creating smaller downtown pockets, kind of like what we've seen happen in Daybreak or West Valley, where they're trying to make it easier for people to live and work in the same area instead of everyone commuting to Salt Lake City, which makes sense when you get more and more dense housing as things go on. You know, what's driving this is that our population is going to continue to grow rapidly. By 2050, there's an expectation that we'll have 2.4 million new Utahns. Right now, the state's population just passed the 3 million mark. So that's a huge increase. And when you think about where they're going to live in the same places the majority of us already live. And these are, you know, this valley is getting quite congested. So that's going to be a major issue. So there's a lot of interest in transportation, transit that makes it work. What they want to do with this survey is find areas where things intersect. So they want dense housing. Well, then you need transportation. And if you're going to have food, well, you could do it in your backyard. There's ways to, like, tie as many issues as they can. And their hope is that the legislature will then start moving in these directions.
And one of the things that you pointed out was people are willing to give up a few things. In the survey, you know, we are willing to drive a little bit less if we have other ways to get places. Homes, cars, landscapes of the future.
Yeah, when they did this, they gave trade-offs. And here's an interesting one. In the future, air pollution in this state won't be primarily by cars. It'll be by your house. That cars will become efficient enough, gas will become clean enough, that the biggest source of air pollution will be the heat and exhaust that comes out of your home because your home's not insulated well enough. So the surveyors responded and said, yeah, we're willing to pay for our own houses to be renovated for this air quality goal of reducing emissions by 40% by 2050. Now, I don't know, I'm a little bit of a skeptic, and I think sometimes it's easy on a survey to say, yes, I will pay more taxes. Yes, I'm willing to pay for new windows and new insulation. And then when it comes down to it, it's harder to actually pull the trigger. And the people behind the survey are aware of this concern. They know that it's great to see that the attitudes are there, but the implementation is something they're going to try to track going forward. And that's the part we'll see whether we actually meet these goals. But it does show that there's a lot of positivity towards what our future is and a lot of cohesiveness from the population about what we actually want in our lives.
What was the reaction to these survey results? I mean, are people embracing them wholeheartedly? Are they a little more cautious that the goals might be too ambitious? Or
even Envision Utah wants to warn people that this isn't going to happen immediately. This is their goal towards 2050, so don't get discouraged if it doesn't happen right out of the gate. But there are plenty of these issues that came up that there is movement on. And here's an example. Our colleague Benjamin Wood wrote an education story today that the legislature is interested in expanding all-day kindergarten to a broader group of students, mostly at-risk students, though some in the legislature want to expand it to every kindergartner. This plan showed overwhelming support for expanding all-day kindergarten. Also, having some more government preschool options as a way to get children onto grade level earlier to increase our academic performance as a state. So here's an example where right out of the gate there is a connection between public policy that's already being debated and what people in Utah want.
But, of course, change will be incremental. So we'll continue to watch that story. Before we head to a break, Kristen, you wrote about a plan, a campaign by the Utah Suicide Prevention Coalition. And they're taking a humorous approach to a very serious issue. Describe this new campaign.
It's not entirely humorous, but it's a little bit. It's kind of like, it's called mantherapy.org, and it's started in Colorado and spread to, is being used in 5 or 6 other states and supposedly with some real success. It's basically a website, and they're going to have another campaign built around that. I think billboards, radio spots, and whatnot. But it's a place where men who have stresses in their lives can look. And it uses humor. It has a character who meets you using the F word bleeped out and whatnot.
He's like a fake therapist.
His name is
Rich,
Dr. Rich Mahogany.
Right.
And he's a little bit self-effacing, but he uses the word manly an awful lot. You know, it's like it the whole message of the thing is using humor, but also somewhat serious, and saying it's manly to get help when you have problems.
So the target audience, 25 to 50
54.
Men. 54.
Yeah, well, yes, largely because nationally and in Utah, that's by far the group that has the most suicides. They account for almost half, and in some years it's over half of the suicides in Utah.
Hmm. Are there any risks to trying to inject humor into such a serious topic?
You know, I'm sure it will put some people off. I mean, some people who already are in deep depression and go and see somebody they may think is making light of their problems, I can imagine that it would really turn some people off.
But why did state officials think that it was worth a try?
Because they in other states where it's been tried, they've been tracking it. They've had social scientists watching it, and they say it's been successful there.
Okay.
So, and they're going to try to quantify what difference it makes here, too. And part of it is because they have just been at a total loss how to reach this group of people. I mean, there have been an awful lot of campaigns around teen suicide. A lot of different projects have really gotten into the schools, and they're working hard on that. There have been some proven measures taken, and you know, still a lot of gains to be made there yet. But they've really not figured out a way to reach men, because men are less likely, supposedly, than women to get help.
If you want to check out more on man therapy, you can check it out at sltrib.com. Talking about the week's news, and we need to take a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW in Salt Lake City, UPR, throughout the state of Utah. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our underplayed story of the week. And because it's Halloween season, I am giving you, our panelists, the option to substitute a spooky or scary story for the underplayed story. So there are a lot of options. Matt Kadam, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I'll go with a scary story for Utah's politicians.
Okay.
How are they going to get on the ballot next year? The state has changed its election process. Before, it was you just go to the convention, you get enough support, you're on the ballot. Now the law changed where you can go to the convention, get on the ballot, or collect signatures to get on the ballot. The Republican Party hates that, and they've taken it to court. And it looks like it's going to be a big, big mess that will go all the way up to the point where the judges are going to have to figure this out, and it could be very convoluted. We had a federal judge this week, Judge Nuffer, say that
Nuffer.
Who is going to say that he told how he's going to rule during the hearing, that he's going to make it so the open primaries are struck from this law. Right now, the Republicans have a closed primary. If you're not a registered Republican, you don't get a vote. They're going to keep it that way. And because of that, it's going to add a lot of problems to how this happens. The Republican Party has also said that they think they made it so if you don't go through the convention route, you don't get to have the Republican label going forward. Now, I've talked to leading politicians in the federal and state level who were totally planning on collecting signatures. And now they don't know what to do. And the state is expecting another lawsuit, because if one candidate tries that signature route and the Republicans say, you're no longer a Republican, they're going to sue. And this is, you know, this process usually starts in January. This judge is going to make his formal ruling next month sometime. So then the next lawsuit starts. How fast are they going to get this done before people need to start collecting these signatures or getting delegates for the convention? This is getting down to the wire, and it is really unnerving some of Utah's biggest politicians.
Definitely a spooky story for them. Dobner, do you have a pick?
I have, well, I have two picks.
Okay.
Actually, I'm helping out my friend, Kristen Moulton, here. So on a lighter note, I would like to point everybody to the story from Michael McFaul that shows that Salt Lake City has been named one of the cities most likely to survive a zombie apocalypse.
Oh, very good.
Which I think
very
is really good. Important.
Finally,
and
some
thank
good
God
news.
For all that Finally. Food storage that we've got here in town. And it's not really an underplayed story, but I did want to, haven't had time to talk about the changes at the Pride Center this week and the loss of Marian Edmonds Allen after only 11 weeks. She's raised, it was heartbreaking, I think, for some people who had were really excited about having her there. She has a long track record of great outreach and doing a lot of good work in the LGBT community, but clearly, based on her resignation letter, there's some challenges at the Pride Center about financing and quality of programming, and maybe right at this moment, not a lot of agreement among board members and Ms. Edmonds Allen about how to get there. So they've been through two tumultuous years of no stability, no director, and now they're going to have to start again. So that might be frightening for some. That might be overstating it, but trying to use a Halloween word.
That succeeded very well. Chris Martin?
A couple of things. One isn't really an underplayed story, but the family of Dylan Taylor is suing Salt Lake City Police Department. We talked about him earlier, the young man who was shot to death last summer who was unarmed. And then the other story that might not be a front page story is that the UT and Salt Lake City were unsuccessful in getting more federal grant money to extend the Sugar House streetcar. So for now, it will stay where it is, which is kind of west of the old Granite Furniture Warehouse. That's the east terminus. And then it goes all the way down to tracks. As everybody knows, the line has been underperforming.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Christopher Smart, Jennifer Dobner, Kristen Moulton, Matt Canham, all of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much for your help today.
Thank you.
Thanks, You're Jennifer.
Welcome. We'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, he remembers being searched by his dad on Halloween night.
Yeah, well, I come home.
He'll shake you down.
Well, I called it a shakedown. He called it investigation. And we both had our points because he knew I was a criminal, even in the sixth grade, and I knew he was looking for candy that he hadn't earned.
But you had earned it?
Yeah, I had earned it. I'd gone out and gone to all those doors and been yelled at and chased by dogs. So, yeah, I had actually, in fact, earned it, along with committing assorted, you know, vandalisms and that kind of thing.
That's another story. You wrote a column about the shakedown by your father.
Yeah, Halloween night. I knew the drill. On the last run of the night, I'd stagger in, drop my trick-or-treat bag at the old man's feet, and immediately assume the position. On the kitchen wall were two spots worn smooth by my hands. The old man was a cop and routinely rousted me. But on Halloween night, it was with a thoroughness normally reserved for spies, murderers, and drug mules. He checked my pockets, shoes, and underpants. He even picked through my hair, looked into my ears, and under my tongue. Mom wouldn't let him force me to drink a laxative. He rarely found anything. I'd learned long ago to cache the felony Halloween stuff behind the garage. Knife, BBs, bar of soap, spray paint, eggs, epoxy, stink bombs, etc. Searching me was for his own good, he would say. He wanted to know what I'd been up to in the past 6 hours, especially if it was something he would have to pay for, like the time I booted a jack-o'-lantern off a porch and set the neighbor's shed on fire.
So often, what your parents did, you'll also adopt Did you shake down your daughters on Halloween?
You know, when I resented the fact that my father was always checking up on me. I'd come home and it was almost like he could read my mind and tell what I'd been up to as soon as I stepped into the house. Later, I figured out that he was just being naturally pessimistic when it came to me. I ended up getting out of a certain amount of trouble because he had been checking up on me. And so when my own daughters came along, I did the same thing he did. When boyfriends started showing up at my daughter's house, I was still a cop, and I was instantly suspicious of these two mullet heads that were hanging around the house with her, and so I ran criminal histories on them and stuff like that. And one of them got really upset, you know, "Oh, it's too bad your dad doesn't trust us." 5 years later, he was a cop. 15 years later, he's doing the same thing to his daughter. And he said, "Tell your dad that I completely get it now." So, yeah. I mean, you're crazy if you don't check up on your kids. Not because they're bad, but because they're kids.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Again, all the Kirby archives are at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, UPR, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis, Roger McDonough at KCPW, Tom Williams, Bennett Purser at UPR, Emily Means from the Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks so much for listening. Have a spooky and safe Halloween.